stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC LPFM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community, and I am your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we're going to be talking with Deidre Enright of the Innocence Project about wrongful convictions and reforms needed to the justice system. Welcome, Deidre.
Hi, Andre. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming. In the sort of run-up to having you on the show, I mean, I've known you for a little while, but I had a little look at your bio online, and I see I didn't even realize you were a UVA law person.
That's right. In 2008, we were asked to make a proposal for an Innocence Project there, and I'm pretty sure they came to me because I'm an alum, and I was in town, and I was working with my husband at the Capitol Resource Center defending death row inmates.
And is that the one in Mississippi?
So that's where we started. So Okay. We left law school.
Tell me about practicing law in Mississippi, doing criminal defense.
It was fantastic.
It's not a word that leaps to mind for me.
And we kind of wondered how it would be to leave from UVA and end up in Jackson, Mississippi. But there was a wonderful criminal defense bar there that sort of welcomed us with open arms. And we lived in Jackson for almost 2 years. And it was fascinating and welcoming in a way that one would not expect.
And yet, somehow, we lured you back to the Ville.
The lure of family, the lure of closeness to our family.
It was our fabulous city, too, right?
You know, it's funny because when you're in law school in Charlottesville, you don't really appreciate.
You don't have any time to appreciate Charlottesville.
But when you have four children and two full-time jobs, you realize that Charlottesville might be the only place you can raise them.
It's pretty nifty. So tell me about how you ended up getting hooked up with the Innocence Project. The Innocence Project started in New York, right?
Right. So the Innocence Project in New York was started by Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld. And they only do DNA cases. Mm-hmm. So they do DNA cases anywhere in the country. So what they're really doing is looking for DNA in cases where anyone's applied in any state.
Now, explain, because you and I know, and this is kind of maybe a stupid question, but just in case somebody doesn't understand what you mean by a DNA case.
Right. So in about 10 to 12% of all criminal convictions, there's DNA that can be tested. And whether we're talking about seminal fluid or hairs or touch DNA that's been left on clothing or items. And then if those items of evidence still exist, they send them to labs in those states and see if they can get a result that will exonerate the individual who's requesting the test.
Okay. So about 10% of cases, you said, have DNA evidence?
10 to 12 is our estimate. It's actually going up now that the science is getting better. So the estimate now is that DNA is 100 times more sensitive, the test, than it was when we started.
Because the technology's changed.
Because the technology is getting better every day. It's in some ways it's outpacing us a little bit.
Right.
Testing mixtures, we're not as good at that. We're good at one person, one piece of evidence. We're not so great at teasing apart lines of DNA.
Different DNA profiles.
But that's what they do.
That's what Scheck and his crew up in New York do.
Yep. And so when we were making our proposal, it seemed better to me for law students to do a clinic where you take not just DNA cases, but any kind of case, because most cases don't have DNA.
Right.
And there's no reason to think that the error rate is any higher or lower in those cases, right? And in fact, in some ways, you might think that when you don't have DNA and you have to use less reliable aspects of the case, like eyewitnesses. So we decided it would be more interesting for law students to work on all cases, right? Not just to be looking for DNA and filing motions to test.
Well, let's back up for a second. Mm-hmm. If you've got a DNA case, you've got a case in which there is existing DNA which can be tested. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Innocence Project is a post-conviction project, right?
Right.
So why wasn't that evidence tested to begin with? Why wasn't it tested before the trial?
So in some cases, some really old cases, it's because the testing wasn't that good or it wasn't even available at the time. So that has happened in some of the old cases.
DNA became available in the 80s sometime, right? Yep. I mean, and it wasn't real wide, didn't become as widespread as it is now. But
right.
I had a murder case a few years back where there was a 20-year-old murder that had not been prosecuted and was then prosecuted 20 years later because the DNA science had changed.
Huh. Is that a case where there was DNA on a cigarette butt
yep,
in a parking lot?
That's yep. the one. That's yep. the Morris case.
Right, right. And that ended in a mistrial.
It did end in a mistrial. And it's not really necessarily, well, we can get into why that happened, but the issue was that the DNA science at the time that the cigarette butt was collected was not sufficient mm-hmm. to make the kind of number of copies of the DNA profile that they needed in order to do the testing.
Mm-hmm.
And on down the line, it became possible to do that. The science got better. And so they tested it and they found a DNA match. The problem with that case was we're talking about a cigarette butt in a parking lot full of cigarette butts.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in which the defendant was known to smoke cigarettes. So it wasn't real compelling
a slam
from
dunk.
That perspective, but that's what that case was about. But the reason I was bringing it up is to sort of make the point that, yes, I know the science changed over time, but it was still, I mean, it was happening in the 80s. There
right.
was some there.
Well, and we have two cases right now where we've learned that in cases where the woman, it was a female victim and she was raped or possibly raped. In both cases, there were perk kits done, but they were not tested. And in both cases, lab analysts came and said, well, we did a slide and we looked at the slide and we didn't see semen. We didn't see spermatozoa.
Mm-hmm.
And so having not eyeballed that, they stopped the testing there, which that seems curious to me that and neither side.
Well, you don't need
they
sperm
both knew.
To have DNA,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Exactly. And neither side made the decision to proceed with further testing. And we don't know if it was inadvertence or that people thought they'd rather not know the answer. I don't know. We're still looking into it. But the tests were available. And that seems very curious to me. That
maybe the attorneys at the time didn't know,
what
you know, depending on what, you know, what age we're talking about, what time period we're talking about, that you could test without just the sperm. I mean, when you have seminal fluid, you have a sperm fraction and you have a fraction that is just fluid.
Right.
And I guess you can test the fluid fraction as well. Yes. I mean, you're not going to get as good a sample is my understanding. I mean, that's really a layman's understanding, and it might not be sufficient if you know a better way to put it.
Well, and when we finish with those cases, I'm going to come back and tell you why, because
uh-huh.
In one case, the attorney is now deceased, so we won't know. At least we won't know her perspective. But in the other case, we're getting ready to file a motion to test, and presumably when we shake out whatever happens, we'll find out why both sides didn't feel the need.
Right.
But,
well,
there you have it.
It's always a risk. I mean, you might test it and you might find someone else. You might test it and you might find something inconclusive. You might test it and you might find out it was your defendant.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, Andre, that's not going to happen.
Not going to happen in
that's
this
not
case.
Happen.
Maybe not going to happen in your case, but there are certainly cases in which I elect not to ask a question.
Right.
As defense counsel. And so I could see a strategic
well, and at
reason
some point, I read something about the New York Innocence Project, and they were saying that in the cases where people apply for their help testing mm-hmm. evidence and in cases where in those cases there's enough to test
mm-hmm.
and in those cases where they can get a result
mm-hmm.
that they exonerate over 40%. But so that means that there's a lot of people writing for help in the hopes that nothing shows up.
So you're saying statistically 10% of cases have DNA evidence that you can test.
That's the street perception.
It's a, well, do you think it, I mean, I know we don't have an exact figure, you can't say for sure, but you think that's somewhere in that neighborhood?
10 to 12 seems to be consistent, 10
okay.
to 12%.
So let's just say, to be on the conservative end of things, which I never am, that is 10%.
Right.
And let's say that when you test those cases, of the ones you've tested, you haven't tested every case in the world in which there's DNA evidence, but when you test them, you find 40% is exoneration rate. In other words, 60% of the time we got it right, 4 out of 10 people in those cases were wrongfully convicted. You're nodding your head, and they can't see you. They can't hear you nodding your head.
Those are some shocking statistics.
Do you think of the 10%, do you think that
Do you think that whole 10% that's the error rate, or do you think that, you know, they're sort of being cherry picked in terms of what is being examined, right? In the sort of way that I say, well, there are times I don't ask the question, right?
Right.
You know,
here's what I don't know the answer to that, although I would imagine that in the 90% of cases that don't have DNA, mm-hmm. The things that are happening in those cases, and we talk about these in categories, even though in cases where there's a wrongful conviction, it's usually, they can usually hit many of the categories. So we have the bad eyewitnesses. Mm-hmm, we now know that mm-hmm. eyewitnesses are far worse than we ever thought mm-hmm. they were, but the law hasn't changed at all. And then we have junk science. And it looks like almost everything except DNA is starting to fall into the junk science category, right? As
right.
time goes on. And we use things and then 20 years later realize that it was terrible. And then you have misconduct, right? Both prosecutorial and police. And then you have ineffective assistance of counsel, right? And you have these lawyers who can't or don't put everything they need to into a case for whatever reasons. So when you start adding all of those things up in the cases where there's not DNA to just be a slam dunk, I think that the error rate, if we ever get to a place where we discover one, is going to be higher than anyone wants to think.
Well, I mean, any error rate at all is higher than I want to think. But,
right.
You know, I'm not that naive. So,
right.
But
I think a lot
about?
Of people
you,
plead,
you think we
too.
Got a 40% error rate in our
I just don't
generally?
Know. And that's part of what's going on in Virginia, right? People talk about you have a right to a trial lawyer, mm-hmm. and you have a right to a direct appeal lawyer, mm-hmm. and then that's the end of due process for you.
Right.
So the only people who are getting a look at these cases again are anybody who's doing post-conviction. And I don't know a lot of people that are doing post-conviction work except my husband's office, Rob Lee, and the Capital Resource Center, and then Innocence Projects.
Why wouldn't a trial lawyer and an appeal lawyer be enough? You got two bites at the apple there.
Right. Well, I don't know if that's really two bites because the direct appeal is confined to the trial record, right?
Mm.
And so you can only revisit things that you can look at a transcript and talk about.
In other words, you can't go outside of whatever the trial lawyer did on direct
right.
appeal, but you can on habeas.
Habeas you can, but by that point, almost everybody who's convicted or pled guilty, they don't have, if they ever had money,
they don't have
any
now, right.
And so I can't even tell you how many letters we get on a daily basis. And we are literally, we have 6 cases in our clinic right now and probably 8 in our volunteer project and a backlog of what is probably over 1,000 at this point. And a lot of the cases, I firmly believe the person is wrongfully convicted, but there's no, the eyewitnesses don't recant,
mm-hmm.
or the jailhouse informants don't admit, and there's no legal remedy for them because the procedural rules are so difficult. The hurdles are astronomical. And so I really am concerned about what our error rate could be. And I don't know any way to establish it without a systematic review of criminal convictions.
I understand. If you're tuning in now, you are listening to WPBC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, and this is Straight Talk with Andre Hakes. And this morning, we are talking to Deirdre Enright at the Innocence Project. So, Deirdre, you had at some point laid out for me different categories of cases that the Virginia Innocence Project looks at. We've talked about DNA. Talk to me a little bit about some of the other categories. What are the categories? How do you break them down?
So I was starting to talk about this. So we say eyewitness identification cases. Those are, you can go to the New York Innocence Project website, and they, I think that's the highest category of wrongful conviction cases is eyewitness IDs.
Higher than DNA?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Really?
Yeah, and I wish I'd looked
higher,
up the
statistics. Higher, but maybe less certain.
Well, and the problem with eyewitness identifications is that you have to prove that they're wrong. So mm-hmm. usually it's a DNA case in that there was DNA to prove mm-hmm. that it was another perpetrator, meaning that the eyewitnesses are wrong.
Right.
But, you know, in a lot of those cases, and if you read the stories, even when there's DNA, eyewitnesses will maintain that they were correct. And, you know, that's probably a function of being unable to bear having been part of wrongfully convicting somebody, but that's how sure, and people get more sure over time, and they get more sure with each sighting of the defendant in court, mm-hmm. right? So we have one of those cases right now, and when we went back to the three eyewitnesses, it was an armed robbery of a beauty salon in Norfolk, and the perpetrators wore disguises and had the people lay face down on the floor, mm-hmm. and they had guns. So, you know, having weapons makes eyewitnesses worse, not mm-hmm. better. You don't get sharper when you're in terror.
Right.
And they identified, 2 weeks later, one of those victims saw our client walking into a club, probably saw the eyeglasses that he was wearing and said, oh, that's the guy. Uh-huh. And then they did a show up and they got our client.
Explain what a show up is.
So in this case, they went and got another one of the victims, came back to the club, had the police look for this, our client. His name is Messiah. He had gone to a payphone to make a phone call. They went over to they rode up on the payphone, handcuffed him and his friend, had them sit on the curb, then drove the victims together past the curb, down the block, and then told them to look out the window, the back window of a cop car. And they asked Messiah to stand up in the street. So, and of course, now they'd seen him several times.
Now here's a guy in handcuffs.
And he's got handcuffs on. And it was also 10 o'clock at night. Right. We've recreated that on video, and we couldn't tell the race of the person who was standing in the street at that time. So anyhow, they did this show up and he was convicted. There's a lots more misconduct that went on, but that was the long and short of it. And when we went back and revisited those eyewitnesses, they did not change their stories. And in fact, they seemed quite firm about what they knew.
I thought cops were supposed to do a lineup where they had, like, you know, you think about the old TV show lineups where they have, like, six guys in stripes, right, you know, and they're standing there, and turn left, turn right, right, you know. And then I've seen a lot of photo lineup cases where they just have a picture of six or eight guys, right, and you flip through the pictures.
Right.
Why did they do it that way?
There should have been a lineup. Our theory now is that what it turns out is that there had been a string of armed robberies in that neighborhood. In fact, 18 of them, with two men who were wearing disguises all the time. And by the time this call came in of a victim saying, we think we see him, mm-hmm. we think they were just so eager to get their hands on him, that, and then 2 days later, the actual guy was picked up. And so they dropped this one robbery out of the series and kept, because they'd gotten an ID.
And so it looked like the robberies had stopped once they had arrested right. your client, because the person who was actually the robber had been picked up on something else.
Right. So 20 years later, after our eyewitnesses don't work out, right, we did a Freedom of Information Act request. We find out about these 18 robberies. We find out the identities of the other people who did these other robberies. We find out that the leader of that was in prison. We went and visited him, described this beauty salon robbery, and he quickly said, oh, well, yeah, that was me. Absolutely. I did that. 20 years later. and that's our next case. We're going to file for him shortly. But that's the eyewitness identification world.
And yet do you have any DNA in that case?
We do not.
So won't the state say, well, we don't believe the person who's in jail who says, I did that robbery?
Well, we certainly hope that they don't do that. And we're hoping that the descriptions of the robberies...
Well, I hope lots of things, but...
Andre, are you going to rain on my
No. I would never do that, dude.
So we're hoping that the similarities of the robberies and the Freedom of Information Act criminal incident reports that describe each one and the conduct and the guns and the clothing and the, along with his admission. It was also in the newspaper at the time that this beauty salon robbery and the others were all believed to be committed by the same people. So we're hoping that the independent evidence that these were all the work of these other people mm-hmm. and not Messiah, who, you know, had a job and had a family and had had no reason to be robbing a beauty salon.
Well, at this point, how long has Messiah been in prison?
He has been in 20 years now. He was 20 when this happened, and he just turned 40.
So he's been sitting in prison for 20 years.
And steadfastly filing anything he could file and writing letters and telling every court in the world. And he actually did that at his trial. There was a mistrial in between his first trial and his second trial. And it was over the fact that it came out at trial that the eyewitnesses had been shown other lineups and that they had picked somebody out. And nobody knew where those lineups were or who showed them or who was in them.
Well, who did they happen to pick out in those lineups?
No, we don't know to this day.
You still don't know.
We still don't know who.
Oh, my God.
And so in the first trial, the judge said, the defense said, we want a mistrial. We don't know what these photos are. We don't know what the detectives, we don't know who showed them.
And so how did they get a mistrial? Was this information that just came out during the trial
Literally.
Itself? Well, why wasn't this disclosed to the defense beforehand?
You ask good questions, Andre. I'd like to offer you a job with our clinic.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But so anyhow, in between, after that mistrial, literally in court that day, the prosecutor came to the defense attorney and said, I want to offer him a deal.
Uh-huh.
He pleads guilty to this armed robbery.
Uh-huh.
He gets 3 years.
Uh-huh.
He's already served one uh-huh. and a half. And Messiah said, absolutely not. And the lawyer said, I begged him to take that deal.
Right.
He said, I told him this is as good a deal as you're going to get.
Right.
Messiah said, that's no deal if you didn't do the crime. It's not
right.
a deal. And so they went back and had another trial. And the same thing happened. Still don't know where the photos are. Still don't know who the person is. And this time the judge did not grant the mistrial. And he received 132
years. 132
years
for a robbery?
An armed robbery where no one was hurt.
How did he get 132 years on a robbery?
So he got a robbery charge for each of the people in the salon. He got a gun charge for the robbery of each of the person in the salon. He got an abduction charge for moving them up to the front of the salon and having them lay on the floor.
Uh-huh.
And a gun charge for each of the abduction
wow.
charges. And magically, during the trial, he became both robbers. So he was both the robber that moved the people up front
uh-huh.
and took all their possessions, and the robber who went to the back of the salon to get somebody out of the bathroom and shot a gun in the air. He was found guilty of being both robbers.
I see. And so if he had taken the deal,
mm-hmm.
he would have been in for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been in for 85% of 3 years, the way prison math works.
Right.
And then he would have been out.
Yep.
But he would have been a convicted felon, sort of branded for life, and nobody would have ever figured this out.
Right.
But he would have only spent 3 years.
And
people ask me, why do people take deals? Why would you plead guilty to something you didn't do?
Exactly.
Wow.
And to this day, I have to say on his behalf, he does not talk about regret for not taking that deal. He certainly is not happy about this intervening, but it matters a lot to him that he didn't take that deal.
Wow,
still.
That's a principled stand, but gee, has he paid for it.
He's paid in spades.
Wow. I guess so. Okay, we've got the bad eyewitness case. We've mm-hmm. talked about DNA. Tell me about some other categories of cases.
So another biggie that for us is a case that is pending now that we filed in Albemarle, and it's a jailhouse informant case.
Oh, the snitch cases. Oh, yeah.
Have you had some snitch cases?
Oh, I've had some snitch cases. Yes, ma'am.
How
yes,
many
ma'am.
Would you say you've had?
I've had a number of them. I don't tend to do that much drug work, which is where you get a lot of that stuff. But I've had a number of them. I had another murder case not too long ago that relied very, very heavily on snitch testimony. And it made for some very fun cross-examination.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended in an acquittal. So there you go.
There you go.
But there was a lot of homework to be done in the interim.
It is a lot of homework.
Oh, yeah.
And you have to look in so many different places to find. And were you listening to calls? Have you been in on
this,
that?
This was a case that I did with Bruce Williamson.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a homicide case. And the problem was ferreting out, after the fact, the word that my clients often use is case jumping. You get somebody who's arrested, they get stuck in the pokey, and then they are looking for a way out of the pokey, and so they try to get other people to talk to them, or they learn about some case that's going on in the papers or on TV or what have you, and they then claim that the person in the pokey told them that they done it. And that's sort of what we had going on.
Was it
here.
During? I love that it's often during a chess game or a card game in the pod.
We might have had a card game in there. I don't know. Uh-huh. We definitely didn't have a chess game.
Uh-huh. Oh, right.
No, the chess game was the trial. but tell me what your experience is.
You
with.
Should know if anybody ever wants to. We've had a friend come to our clinic who's a capital public defender, Doug Ramser, who's put together.
I've heard of Doug.
Mm-hmm, he's put together this presentation that he did for a case, and we use that in this case as well, where we got recordings of the jailhouse calls, mm-hmm. right, for the different informants, snitches, whatever you want to call them, and hear them getting the information from girlfriends, mm-hmm. mothers, wives, mm-hmm. who are then calling the courthouse. Mm-hmm. You can literally hear the clerk of the court reading, and they're saying, could you pull this file and tell me who, what he's convicted of, what is the, you know.
Wait, I'm confused. Mm-hmm. How do these calls end up being recorded if they're between the girlfriend who's out and the clerk of court?
So they're three-waying the call, right? The boyfriend calls the girl.
Uh-huh.
She and he says, now do it. She's hasn't done it.
Right.
As she's supposed to have done it. He says, call now.
Right.
And so she's calling the clerk of the court, uh-huh. and saying, this is case number, this file. Uh-huh. Can you just read to me? And you can literally hear the clerk of the court reading the information that he needs. Or the girlfriend is also clipping the newspaper and sending it to him so that he can put together enough information to claim that he has independent knowledge that came from the inmate. And in the case that we did, we even found that one of the people that was testifying arguably wasn't even in physical proximity to our client. Couldn't have
yeah,
gotten
how this. Do you ever prove that? I mean, you got people who are in the same facility. How do you
right.
ever prove that, you know, they didn't pass each other in the hallway?
Right.
How do you prove
right.
negative like that?
Right. Well, and we try, you know, the way it was tried was to say these people were being housed in the cafeteria at the time and they would never have come, you know.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. Proving the negative, almost impossible. But independent of any evidence, there was just six informants,
right?
And the great piece of it was talking to people later and finding out that, you know, at the Albemarle Jail, for I don't know how long, all anybody was doing was talking about who's going to jump on his case.
Right.
Are you going to jump on his case? And coming up with phrases that would be seductive for prosecutors, right?
Well, how did you find this out?
What do you mean?
I mean, how did you find out they were coming up with phrases that would be... give me a phrase that's seductive to a prosecutor.
So the one that everybody liked so much and that the jurors remembered was, for the lick I did. They mm-hmm. got me for the lick I did.
For the
and
lick
what's the
I
lick?
Did.
The lick, the robbery. What lick? The big robbery. You know, like
right, okay.
say lick as many times as you can and
okay.
scare the jurors. And
how did you find out that people in the jail were like talking about how to phrase this?
Because
so that
we
it would
went
stick?
And interviewed not just the informants, and some of whom recanted, of course,
mm-hmm.
But we also went and talked to anybody we could find who was listed in the file. And then anybody we talked to, we would say, who was your in your pod? Then mm-hmm. they would give us more names. And so we literally just spent weeks going around to jails, federal. Some people were out. Some people were still in. And everyone was happy to tell us that it was easy to do. It was easy to concoct the stories. Everybody knew the state needed people.
Why would they tell you that? They know you're working for the defendant, right? And if they get busted now,
right? So I think they just think there were a couple guys too that had decided not to get involved
uh-huh.
and thought that what was happening was pretty disgusting. Like
uh-huh.
they had gone in and gotten debriefed and then uh-huh. said, "Yeah, I'm not doing this." And the most depressing part about that case was that it seemed like the local guys were all getting together and dumping on, as they said, the guy from Guam. And our client was from Guam.
Oh.
And they were saying how there was going to be no, everyone told us, there will be no problem for you because he has no people. He's here from Guam. There can't be any retaliation on the street. He has nobody that we have to worry about.
I see.
So that was sort of the whole motivation.
Okay, I think we need to take a break at the moment. We'll be right back with Deirdre Enright.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
So, we were talking about what I like to call snitch cases in the jail. And you were saying how people would kind of case jump.
Right.
In these cases. Is there anything else you want to say about that kind of case before we move on to?
Well, the only thing that I realize about, I know that some jurisdictions won't even use jailhouse informants, and some people at least have a cautionary instruction, which in that case, none was given, to at least be.
There's not a model jury instruction for jailhouse informants, is there?
So some states have things that say this sort of testimony should be viewed with, you know, the utmost of suspicion and treated cautiously. And, you know, I've heard people say, oh, you know, jailhouse informants, you don't even have to worry. They're so incredible. Nobody has to worry about them.
Oh,
but
my God.
In our case, one of the people took the stand, said he didn't want to testify, then said, you know, the prosecutor was saying, what have you and I talked about? And he was like, I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. He left the stand. He came back later and said that the reason that he had taken that little break was because he was so scared of our client.
Right.
And in fact, we have a theory that that's not at all why he
left. No, what happened is he went off the stand and then the prosecutor or the cop came back to him and said, we're going to hammer the heck out of you if you don't say what we want you to say.
Right. And exactly. And so, but what was amazing was that when we interviewed the jurors in post-conviction, they said to us, even the jailhouse informant was afraid of your client. And they put a lot of weight on that. And
right.
I thought this whole idea that jurors are suspicious of jailhouse informants, you know, maybe in some cases, but in that case, not only were they not suspicious, they found that credible. That which was utterly ridiculous, they found that to be credible, and that person was afraid of our client from Guam.
Got it. I understand. Do you think that was orchestrated in that case, in that, you know, it was decided ahead of time that this is what that person would do? Or do you think that that person really had sort of qualms about testifying against him, and then when he went back out in the hallway and got read the riot act, those qualms went away.
Well, what we learned and is included in our brief was that he had planned to offer his testimony and his version of events along with a cellmate.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got to trial, that person wasn't there.
Mm.
And he did not want to have his story out there alone, mm-hmm, without the other person both telling the same story, mm-hmm, and getting a deal so that they could share responsibility.
Oh, I see.
And that person didn't show up. And so we believe that that deal got renegotiated in the break.
Right.
And then he became.
And of course,
willing.
What did he say when he was? I assume the prosecutor asked him, were you promised anything? I mean, were any,
of
you know, consideration for your. And he said no.
They all said, I hope.
I hope.
I hope.
Oh, I hope.
I hope I can get something. But now the defense attorney also said to him, which was part of our brief, did anyone come talk to you during,
mm-hmm,
that break?
Mm-hmm.
And he said no. And we've later been told that there was discussion and a prosecutor did come talk to him.
Whoa. I understand if the cop came and talked to him, maybe the Commonwealth attorney wouldn't have known it. But you're saying the Commonwealth attorney who was prosecuting the case went out in the hallway and talked to him, and they then let him take the stand and say no?
Yes, and sat silent when.
Where did this happen?
In Albemarle County.
Okay. All right. Well, that is.
So that's kind of shocking, right?
That is kind of shocking. I'm kind of blown away by that.
There's also, and I don't know if this happens in your cases, but there's also a lot of, there were both federal and state inmates in that case. And
uh-huh,
there was a lot of discussion about no, but telling people, well, no, that's my federal case, but this is a state case, and
right,
these are separate. Do you have that?
Therefore,
going on?
I've got a federal charge, and I'm going to get credit on my federal charge.
Well, no,
but I'm
like
testifying in
insinuating
a state case?
That because I'm a federal inmate, I can't get any help here in the state.
Oh,
or I'm a state inmate, and that's can't be any.
Oh, I see. I understand. Sort of to imply that They must be telling the truth. They're not just doing this to get something because they're in a separate system. Right. But, of course, we know that the two systems talk to each other all the time and the deals are negotiated. And some of our prosecutors have dual prosecutorial authority. Some of them prosecute in the state court and also as federal prosecutors sometimes.
Right. Wear both hats.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yes.
So... let me ask you now, well, if you're just tuning in, you are listening to Straight Talk with Andre Hakes on WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, and my guest today is Deirdre Enright of the Innocence Project. Deirdre, you have experience in some cases where the police withhold exculpatory information. We've touched on that briefly. Do you want to talk about that kind of as a category of case?
So that's a growing... that's where a lot of relief has been obtained in post-conviction cases.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the biggest, most notorious ones that we got to participate in were Justin Wolfe in Northern Virginia. He was on death row. And
give me a recap of what was Justin convicted of.
So it was 2001 and it was Northern Virginia. And he was a low-level 20-year-old selling marijuana to his friends, and his supplier was shot and killed. And very quickly, they identified the shooter as being Owen Barber. He had the car, he had the gun, he threw the gun, and pretty quickly, he admitted to being the shooter.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't sufficient. They wanted him to have been hired by someone.
Why did they want him to have been hired by someone?
I think that probably the police recognized that because that person had a lot of marijuana and ecstasy in his house, the victim, that this was a murder for a purpose. Whether it was... now, because there was still money in his car and there were still drugs in his house, they probably thought there was more to the story at the time. Now, as you know, there was very little discovery in that case, as there is in most criminal cases. So what later became known to us was not known at trial. But when they were bringing Owen Barber back from San Diego, where they found him, he kept repeatedly saying, "What's in this for me? If I talk to you, what do I get?"
Right.
And they said, "We've got you as the shooter. There's very little for you. There's very little play here for you." They said, "Unless you give us Justin Wolfe as your hirer."
Are you kidding?
They used his name. And in fact, they wrote a police report documenting that they said the name. And he said at some point, "What if I gave you the hire?"
He said, "Who's Justin Wolfe?"
Like, sure. Can you spell that? Is that Wolfe with an E? He said at one point, you know, what if I gave you the higher ups, suggesting, that it was the higher ups?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "No, it's Justin Wolfe."
Why did they think it was Justin Wolfe, or why did they want Justin Wolfe implicated?
So, again,
hard to say.
It's unclear whether the state wanted to have a death penalty case and didn't want to lose him to a federal drug conspiracy because the feds were involved in investigating this drug conspiracy. And this was Paul Ebert's office.
Oh, and this would give them a death penalty case because murder for hire gives you a capital case. Now, why would they want a death penalty case?
Well, Paul Ebert, who is been the prosecutor for the longest amount of time of any prosecutor in Northern Virginia, and he likes to brag about how many people he's put on death row. And in fact, in this case, when he was brought into a federal district court to testify, his favorite new answer is, "Oh, how many people you put on death row? Oh, I don't know. I've stopped counting. 15, 16. I don't know. I've stopped counting." So I don't know. But I know that if they had continued the investigation through the feds, it's very unlikely that the federal government would have thought that this was a death penalty case.
I see.
But Prince William peeled off this portion of it. The federal drug conspiracy investigation continued, and they prosecuted Justin Wolfe.
So the police said to this fellow who had confessed to shooting the guy, and presumably in his confession to shooting him, he didn't say, "I was hired by someone." He just said, I shot him.
He said Justin. Ultimately, he came up with Justin paid
right, but before,
me.
Before he's coming in the car with the cops, right, he tells them he's done this.
Right.
And then they're in the car with him, and they say, you know, we can't really do much for you unless you tell us that this specific person hired you to do this shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, oh, well, yes, that person hired me to do the shooting.
Right. And paid me in drugs and money. And
that is
was
amazing.
Gonna,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
And so years go by, right? Justin's convicted.
Was this, did defense counsel know this? Were they told?
No. In fact, so that's the discovery piece of this. He got that police report naming, saying, we want Justin Wolf.
Uh-huh.
And 10 other pieces of evidence, significant pieces of evidence,
uh-huh,
other people who had a motive
right
to kill, who were in town at the time,
right,
who the girlfriend of the victim had said, he's afraid something bad is going to happen to him.
Uh-huh.
Didn't have anything to do with Justin Wolf.
Uh-huh.
Had to do with kicking a higher up out of a drug deal. Right.
Uh-huh.
I mean, all of that was withheld. And the defense attorney was later disbarred for neglecting his other clients while he tried to save Justin Wolf.
But of course they didn't give him the information. So
he had a blindfold on his eyes and his hands tied behind his back. The idea that he could have ever. So years later in federal district court, Judge Raymond Jackson ordered discovery be turned over. And there was a lot of fighting about whether there was going to, who was going to turn over what.
Discovery? What? How do you spell that? What is that?
I don't know. I'm going to ask
somebody. I've not seen a whole lot of that.
Well, we ended up getting thousands and thousands of pages. So there was like a 9-page discovery response that the Commonwealth had offered at trial. And then in the end,
at trial, they
at
offered
trial,
a discovery response.
It was a summary.
At trial?
It was a summary of, you know, here's some things that could have happened, might have happened, that you could use. Now, I don't know what a summary would be worth. So one of the things that happened that no one knew about, or no one knew for sure, was that witnesses were being interrogated together so that they could coordinate their stories. And now Mr. Ebert testified that that was so he could figure out who was telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And Judge Jackson reminded him that he had he'd taken the jury's role away by doing that. But people over the years had said to us, oh, no, I know that because I was in a room with another witness, and that's how we were told to testify. So the coaching of witnesses had happened, and now we have an alternate suspect. And now there's anyhow, all of that is why the Judge Jackson and then the Fourth Circuit said we're vacating that conviction. We're vacating all the sentences. And, you know, one of their lines in their opinion was, you know, we hope that the Commonwealth will heed this rebuke. And Michael Hash, likewise, was a young boy in Culpeper who served 10 years before many, many pieces of exculpatory evidence came out during a federal district court hearing. And he, too, was given relief. So the hiding
what
of...
What happens to the prosecutors who do this? When in those cases where you finally are, through extraordinary effort, able to ferret this out, what happens to the Commonwealth attorneys
who
did it?
Well, Paul Ebert just got reelected. So that's what happened to him. Gary Close, who was responsible for Michael Hash's conviction, he resigned immediately, but now has writing for a newspaper in Culpeper and has claimed to be the victim in that case, and that Michael Hash sort of got away with murder. And so not much is the answer. Certainly bar complaints have been filed against Paul Ebert, and there's been no result.
What about Close? Did Close get a bar complaint?
He did. And before the hearing, there was some settlement to avoid the hearing, and he was reprimanded publicly.
In other words, somebody said, bad prosecutor.
Bad boy. Yes.
But he's still got a law license.
I don't know if he has a law license, to be honest. I don't think he's practicing because I think he's writing. He's returned to his journalistic career. I know
so
nothing.
They might have suspended him.
I don't know.
We're not sure.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
But I'll find out.
All right.
So, yeah, not much happens is just the truth of it. Certainly, this if defense attorneys did similar things, something would happen. But
well, now, what makes you say that?
I'm jaded. yeah, and I don't really know how these things stop happening if there is no consequences, because there's no incentive in the moment when you're in the middle of a trial and you want to win, which is appears to be what people want to do, right? Mm-hmm. So the obligations of the prosecutor are to seek justice and to seek convictions. But in these cases, it seems there's only one.
We lost sight of one. And...
Right. Now, just to be fair, too, Justin Wolf was reindicted for all of those things by the neighboring prosecutor and is, you know, facing more serious charges than ever before, even though I believe the real perpetrators were identified in the discovery.
Mm. Wow. But we don't know the outcome yet of that.
No.
That case.
No. I think there's a trial date set for January of 2017.
Gotcha. Well, I wanted to cover a couple things with you, and I don't have a whole lot left to cover it with. But briefly, I understand there are also cases that you would classify as police misconduct cases. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what kind of cases you're putting in that category?
Well, so generally, there's the police misconduct that just involves tunnel vision, right? Focusing on a single person and going in that direction.
This is kind of idea where if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Exactly. And, you know, and in some ways, I think I feel sympathetic to law enforcement because I feel like they have to live in fear constantly. And I would hate that. And I think it would probably change the way I viewed the world. But then you have the bad cops, right? You have the Robert Glenn Fords in Norfolk, where you're terrorizing people into false confessions, right? And
how do you get a false confession out of somebody? Why would anybody say, I did it, when they didn't?
So we've had cases where people just give up, right? They see no hope for getting out of the room. And because police are allowed to lie, people tell our clients, look, all you have to do is make this right and you can go home. You know, and people think, oh, well, I wasn't aware that if I confessed to rape, murder, robbery, I could go home. But since that seems to be the case, I'd rather just go home.
Well, isn't that a promise? Doesn't it get thrown out, or doesn't the person then say, well, I was promised X, and so that's why I confessed, and so the confession's no good?
No, it appears that people think that is just wily behavior by the defendant, right? And that since they're allowed to, because we've embraced the theory that the truth will come mm-hmm. right out, even if you lie to them. And so you say, we have your DNA here. And that when people start to think, oh, how did my DNA get at this crime scene, right? And we have a client who was involved in the Michael Hash case who said, I'd never seen photos of dead people before. I was very young. They told me that you can black out and commit a crime. And he came to believe that that must have happened because he had no idea that people could lie to him. He never thought the police could lie to him. And so he literally, and many false confession cases are like that. There's a person who comes to believe that they were involved. And only over time and with other lawyers, and when they get to see what everyone else is saying, do they realize I was had, right? So there's so many cases where that could happen.
You mean the person confessing is convinced by the officer that they must have committed the crime?
Right.
And then they agree that they did, and then later on they become convinced that they didn't commit the crime.
Right. And it takes, especially young people.
How do you convince somebody that they committed a crime they didn't commit?
I think the people who are vulnerable are always the young people or people with mental health issues, or so that's the category where it seems to happen the most. But you can watch videos of like there was a case that Steve Braga did at the law school where it's a young kid and he's being told that he killed his parents. They find his parents dead in the house, and they're telling him he's the only person in the house.
How old is this kid?
He was young. But you watch the video, and he's weeping and saying, why did I do that?
How old?
I want to say 12, 13. But just weeping. And he has since grown up, been exonerated, gone to law school. But you know.
So they said, you killed your
parents.
You
must have killed your parents.
And they told him all this. And he said, why did I do that? And that's a confession.
Yeah. And ultimately, he believed for years that he must have killed his parents. And of course, later they found out it was a wealthy businessman who there was a deal that had gone bad and whatever. But even when I see people who confess who are not young, who are not, I can easily see the lying and the emotional manipulation as being powerful. Like when you look at a little tiny interview room, like shaken baby cases, this is the classic, right? We have one too. The person didn't confess, but you tell a parent that the other parent, one of them had to have done this. And then they can't imagine who, but somebody's going to fall on the sword at some point, right? And they tell you the child is going to die unless you tell us what you did to that child. And in cases where the child is already dead, the child has already died, and they're just trying to get the confession, right? And there's some awful, awful video you can watch. And
wow.
I feel like I've been a very, very cheery influence here today.
You have. I mean, whoa. We've got about 5 minutes before I need to wrap the show up. And I'm so not done with you.
You're kicking me out.
I do not want to kick you out, but I might ask you to come back sometime because this has been really kind of fascinating. But I do want to, in the remaining time, I want to talk to you about what kind of changes could be made to the system that might help solve some of these problems. You know, do you see a way forward here? I mean, surely there are people who have committed crimes who need to go to prison.
Surely.
I mean, surely there are.
I've never met one, but I've heard about that.
Yeah, well, you've never met one. And I've never met one who I represented, but, you know, the ones that I don't represent, some of them do. But the problem is there are people who have not committed the crime who are going to prison. What kind of changes do you think could be made to decrease that problem,
so
to make this more reliable?
I see so many ways. So first of all, there were discovery and open file policy could just be mandated. And that seems like a no-brainer to me. If the only way that you can win a criminal case is by hiding information, then you got no business trying that case. And the pay that people receive, defense attorneys, these ridiculous fees that they get, to do what we do in our cases, which...
You're talking about court-appointed counsel, right?
Well, yeah, but although I think it happens on both sides. And I just...
And what do you mean by ridiculous?
Because I look at what we need to do. Now, some of our cases, we solve in a way that you think, okay, defense counsel could have done what we just did in one afternoon, right? But there's other things that you think... Lawyers aren't investigators, and always they should get better at it, but they aren't. We could pay investigators to do better jobs, you know, on this side. We could even the score.
What's a defense attorney, an appointed defense attorney, paid on a serious felony?
You're going to tell me that.
I think it's like $1,200.
I was going to say $1,350.
Yeah, but I mean, it's something in that area.
So when Jay Connell and Claire Cardwell and I offered to represent Daryl Rice on his state case in Prince William, when he was indicted after the federal charges fell apart, we spent maybe a year and a half. There was massive amounts of evidence that could or might be used against him. And mostly we got that because we had done the federal case. So we had discovery that we wouldn't have had in the state case. The three of us volunteered to represent him pro bono because we knew that if we didn't, he was charged with three felonies and it was going to be $1,150 for each of those three. That was what a appointed counsel was going to get.
So $3,450.
And we probably, between the three of us, put over $1 million into defending him on free time. Now, should that have been, that was a total vindictive prosecution that was done because the federal case fell apart, all of that. That's not the norm. But he would for sure have gone away for a very long time if we hadn't done that.
The Harris murder case, the one that I was talking about that we had all the snitch testimony, Bruce Williamson did that case with me.
Right.
And the judge asked me if I would take an appointed case. And I said, no, I don't do appointed work, but I might consider doing a case pro bono. And I ended up taking that case pro bono. And what I leveraged was I said, if you let me pick court-appointed counsel of my choosing, then I'll do this case pro bono. And I ended up getting Bruce to do it with me. And Bruce was fabulous. Wow, he was great.
I heard you were too.
I was not fabulous, but he was really fabulous. And in the end, I figured out that I had put, it was well over $100,000 worth of time into that case, for which I got paid zero. I think it was $165,000 or something. And I basically, you know, ate it at my firm for the next 3 years.
I was going to say, but, how did they feel?
Well, my partners were, you know, my partners are great folks. Right. And they understood that this was something I needed to do. And, you know, they carried me through it. And, you know, now I'm back to making money and, you know, life is good. But I don't think they'd want me to do one every year. I can tell you that. And,
right.
You know, that was one
right.
case.
Right. And so, I just think with, especially 30, now.
$34.50 is would you like fries with that? Less than would you like fries with that?
It's also, you know, I say this all the time, but somewhere along the line, in a lot of these cases, what we're calling due process has actually become process. And our concern that we're going to solve crimes has just become resolve the crimes, right?
Right.
And somewhere along the line, we've lost interest in being accurate. And the idea that I can just fall over wrongful conviction cases in a clinic with 12 students is ridiculous, right? We're getting it wrong. We don't know how much, but we're getting it wrong. And I wish we could just transfer what we do to the trial lawyers so that it doesn't ever happen.
Well, we know we're getting it wrong 40% of the time in the DNA cases that have actually been explored.
Right.
That's amazing. Well, Deirdre, thank mm-hmm. you so much for coming
Andre,
and talking to me today.
Thank you for having me.
And I might ask you to come back sometime because I really, really enjoyed this interview.
I may promise to come. I'll make you sorry.
No, not at all. So you are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Andre Hakes, and this has been another edition of Straight Talk. Next week, we are going to have Heidi Altman coming on the show from the CARE Coalition, which is an immigrants' rights group. And we're going to talk about immigration issues generally and specifically about some of the things that happen to immigrants who are charged with criminal offenses and how the system disproportionately affects them. So have a great weekend, everybody.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hakes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August. Engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.